Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We're tonight's entertainment.
Look at my butt. Now look at my front butt.
Wada, 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 wada.
Open the circuit to the wave motion gun. Open the circuit.
Blood chamber pressure increases.
All the ship's energy is now in the wave motion gun.
I doubt anyone here would recognize civic virtue if it reached up and bit you in the ass.
Oh, did I hurt your feelings?
Only Magneto's right. There's a war coming. You sure you're on the right side?
Sorry, everybody, I got lost there for a second, but what can I say about my first guest? He's the man. He's the myth. He's the legend. He is the mustache that every other man should live up to nowadays. And here he is, the one, the only, a little fanfare first.
Henrik Cueto.
Oh, Henry. Yeah. Hey, at least you got it at the beginning.
Definitely.
Well, my last name was Ron Keo. I have a list of the stupid ways they mispronounce my name.
Oh, yeah, it happens all the time. I'm sure you're very well aware of that. So how you doing, my man?
Oh, I'm doing all right. How Heinrich is... an independent filmmaker, how many years have you been at this?
I made my first feature-length film when I was 18 years old, so I guess 13 years. Yeah, 13, almost 14 years.
What put the bug into you? 14. What put the bug into you? What got you to want to make films?
Well, I loved movies for as long as I could recall. I mean, pretty much... from the time I could watch movies, I was picking them in the rental shelves. So at a very young age, I was obsessively watching movies. And I guess I was just kind of an odd kid who, you know, wanted to be creative. And that kind of fed into it as well. So before before my family had a home video camera, I would actually use a tape recorder and record, like, radio skits at home and things like that, you know, just any excuse to be creative. And when I was 12 years old, I became the youngest volunteer ever at my community access channel. And that was where I really started to learn how to, you know, use video cameras and edit footage and things like that.
Sounds like this has been more of a passion than just an addiction to you.
Yeah, it's definitely pulled me pretty much my entire life. It's really had a bearing. Very little I've done in life is not related to filmmaking and stuff like that.
when did you get the epic mustache? That's the first thing people see when they see a picture of you. They look at the epic mustache.
That started when I was about 22, 23 years old. So that was about 10 years ago. I had grown a mighty beard, and when I decided to get rid of it, I was getting rid of it in pieces. And at one point, I had just a mustache, and I curled the ends, and, well, the rest is history.
But, yeah, you really started putting your films out right when DVD was starting to get big, right?
No, I actually started putting out my films right when DVD was starting to diminish.
Oh, well, yeah, about right. But yeah, those were the amazing times when it first started, wasn't it? Anybody could get any movie distributed to a store because they wanted product, because everybody was buying DVDs.
Yeah, I'm envious. I wish I had been able to really experience it. Because it seems like it was an incredible time. I have a lot of friends and colleagues who were working in the business at that time, and you know, it was a great time for exposure, a great time for profits for so many filmmakers.
Yeah. And the first time I ran into any of your stuff was an article in Secret Scroll magazine about you and your films.
Oh man, Secret Scroll is awesome. Mike at Secret Scroll, he's one of the coolest guys I know, and he's been such a longtime supporter of my work, and I really appreciate it. It's so cool that you read about it there. He wrote an incredible piece.
Back when he was putting it out, again, I usually got him at the drive-in fest to be in the next month where he was always selling them.
That's awesome. I'm glad to hear that it moved you to check out my work. I really appreciate it.
Well, I'm always more interested in the little guys because they either had to try to do something different or they just didn't give a damn and said, okay, I'll make the movie with the guy chasing someone and trying to kill him with an apple because I can.
Exactly, yeah. There's less to lose. You have nothing to lose, everything to gain, so you just go for it.
Yeah. How many movies have you got out now?
I have 15 features out in the world with a 16th one that is in post-production right now as director, and then I've done about 20 movies as producer.
Oh, cool. Have you ever got to see any of your films on the big screen yet?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Pretty much every film that I direct, I hold some kind of a premiere where the cast, crew, friends, family, and fans in the local area can come out and see it. We usually hold them at this little theater out in my area called the Baijiu Theater, which is a family-owned and operated theater. So, and we often hold screenings in and around the Dayton, Ohio area.
Yeah. I always love those little tiny theaters the most because they're more willing to let guys like you or smaller guys rent out the theater.
Definitely.
But I'm 50. I'm old enough to remember the old roadshow days.
Oh, I'm sure those were phenomenal. They were awesome, I bet.
Well, just imagine you would basically rent the theater for a week, give the guys who own the theater a cut, and then you would just go in and take over the theater for a whole week.
Yeah, they called that four-walling.
Yeah, four-walling or roadshowing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I've heard of people doing things kind of reminiscent of that in this day and age, but it's just not quite the same.
And the festival circuit's still doing good, but I think it's starting to get to the point where I've seen some of the better horror festivals start going Sundance.
Yeah, I've had very few and not very positive experiences with film festivals, so I generally don't even bother.
Yeah. But it isn't. I always like talking to little guys like you because they're probably more interested and enjoy films more than the guys who work on the big multi-million-dollar budget films and just want to get it out there so they can get more work.
I mean, I don't know a whole lot of those guys, but I do know that that most of the people who work at my level, they definitely love movies. I mean, there's because otherwise, you know, why not sell real estate? You know, if you're not doing it because you just have a real strong affinity for it.
Yeah, if you don't love what you're doing, then change.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you just strictly horror, or are you right now trying to get into your my movie phase?
I've actually, about 60% of my output has been horror. I've directed comedies, dramas. I did a family movie. I've done a Western. So I've done a bunch of different stuff. I think I've done about 7 or maybe it's 8. I can't remember off the top of my head, non-horror films as a director.
Yeah. I forget who said, but when I say that, I mean, it's like most directors get into a phase where they want to make, as they say, I want to make my Western. I want to make my action film. I want to make my kiddie film, you know.
Mm-hmm. I try to make every film I create, you know, inherently mine in some way, even if I'm doing the film for hire or doing it, you know, as a job. But there are definitely some films that get to be, you know, they get to be much more personal than others. I've had a lot of good fortune with the comedies I've made, which are a bit more, for lack of a better term, a bit more artsy or a little bit more, I guess artsy is really the best word I could think of for it. But you know, there's a lot to like in just about any movie. I think that's one of the challenges as a working director is to find what you enjoy in any film you do, regardless of the content, regardless of the genre. If you're going to direct it, you have to care very much about the story you're telling.
Yeah, and you're one of the few guys I've seen come out of the indie scenes of the early 2000s that really didn't get into the extreme genre.
I never was that into that personally. The closest thing to extreme that I really did was Babysitter Massacre, which wasn't, you know, extremely violent, but, you know, had a very high body count, a lot of blood. I mean, it was a slasher movie. What do you expect? And I'm getting ready to film Babysitter Massacre 2, and then 3 and 4 are also scheduled to be shot later this year. We crowdfunded those on Kickstarter last year. And they're going to be, you know, bloody, violent horror movies, but they'll probably not kind of cross that level into the extreme horror space. I just, since I've never been that into watching it myself, although there are several that I really like, I felt like there's no way I could deliver that to an audience and make them happy, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Since you're filming back to back to back, you should do a scene in one of the Babysitter Massacre films where the main girl and the killer get confused. And then they have to figure out which script they're doing.
I'll take that under advisement.
Yeah. It's like, are you supposed to why you got a ball bat? I don't remember it being anything. Crap, this was supposed to be in 4, not 2. Forget that. But, yeah, I mean, it just seems like you're one of the few people I can tell have that sense of fun about your work. I've seen two people take it too seriously.
It'd be hard to take it seriously because, you know, if there wasn't a largely fun element, I don't know how I would I'd be able to keep going for as long as I have. You know, it's definitely not an easy way to make a living, and it's definitely not for the faint of heart. It's, you know, a lot of stress, a lot of ups and downs, and a lot of, you know, real hard struggle. So, yeah, you have to love it, and it has to be fun, or else I couldn't imagine getting up every day and doing it.
Yeah. what's sad is with the DVD boom, you see a lot of the companies like treat independent horror or smaller films like The Spare Tire Girlfriend. When they need the girl, oh, she's always there for them, and they treat them right. But as soon as they get something else, or they feel like they don't need them anymore, oh, just go away. We don't want to bother with you anymore.
That's true. You know, the way the market always seems to be is that the independents test out new things, like whether it's Netflix or even, you know, video, you know, the VHS and DVD. The independents are always willing to take the risk early, and then the studios always join late. But then once the studios join in and the big money comes in, a lot of times there's not a lot of benefit to the companies to kind of stick with the people who brought them to the dance. And it does stink. It happens a lot.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is the companies get starry-eyed when they get the big movies and stuff like that.
Well, and I mean, then the checks are huge, you know. I mean, money is the goal. So once they see huge dollars, a lot of times there's not a lot of motivation to keep them going with independence.
Yeah. Do you like Alejandro Jodorowsky?
Alejandro Jodorowsky? I like some of his work. I like El Topo quite a bit.
Well, have you seen Dance of Reality?
I have not.
Well, the opening scene, it shows like a showering of gold coins falling down, and he says, "This is your God. This is what has helped and hindered you the most in this world. You hate this more than anything, but you need it more than you ever will admit."
Doesn't sound wrong.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, it was funny. When Netflix started out streaming, I would see almost all sorts of no-budget, low-budget films, exploitation from the 80s, the good stuff.
Yeah, they were
but
definitely
they
much
got
more
the
into that at the beginning.
TV shows and they got kicked off there. We don't need you anymore.
Well, now Netflix doesn't really even want that stuff anymore. I mean, Netflix's plan is definitely to create and own as much content as they can, which, you know, I don't know if that's really the wisest business model for them or not. I mean, I'm not an expert in distribution, so, you know, they're going to do what they're going to do.
Spending $100 million on a Martin Scorsese film that they don't even plan on giving a screen-wide release.
It's not in their purview, I guess. I mean, at that point, can you blame them, or would you blame Martin Scorsese, who knew that they were not going to want it to be theatrical?
Yeah.
It's complicated.
Well, you know Joe Weinkoop, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He says Netflix is at the point where there's no one watching the books.
I couldn't say. I don't have any insight into Netflix.
Well, it's one of those, like, it happens to all the small companies. They start doing great, and then they start pumping money into releases, or like Shout Factory, putting out all sorts of titles that really aren't necessary to put out, and really not caring how much they get back in.
Well, Netflix is definitely spending an incredible amount of money. I don't know about Shout Factory. Shout Factory has always seemed to be a pretty careful business model, but Netflix is definitely spending tens of billions of dollars, which is pretty startling. But whether it'll be sustainable or not is anybody's guess.
I would hate to see the little guy's reaction to directors complaining, "I only got $10 million to make this movie. How am I supposed to make this vision?"
Well, I mean, the fact is, no matter how much money you have for a movie, it's never enough. That's something that is very true. A great poet once said, "Mo money, mo problems," and it's true.
Yeah, I mean, really, I could see guys like you or Christopher Mim or some of the other smaller guys. Here's $10 million. What can you do with it? I can make you about 3 or 4 movies.
At least 3 or 4.
Yeah. But it is sad. Amazon, only difference between what Amazon did and what Netflix did is Amazon is doing this in public, and Netflix was quiet about it.
Well, that's not exactly true. Amazon did something that no other major video streamer ever did, which is they had an open door policy. They allowed you to put your content on their service and become a part of it. Netflix just didn't renew their licenses. Netflix just decided that once the terms were up on the contracts, they would not deal with them anymore. Amazon asked us all to come and put our content on there, and then decided, instead of telling us we're going to shore in on how much of the content we carry, instead they just kind of, well, they haven't said anything. They've just decided that all of a sudden films that were in good standing for 3-4 years are now no longer in line with their content policy guidelines. And that's all we get.
Whereas,
we don't get anything
you
else.
You said yesterday what you got, and I've heard it from a few, there is no interest by any of our viewership in this content in the current time, so we are taking it off our what?
I mean, it's even more long and confusing and lawyer sounding than that. So it's just, but it, you know, the fact of the matter is I kind of just wish they'd say, you know, we can't do it anymore. It's not sustainable, whatever. So therefore, we're, you know, reconsidering all of the titles that are on our platform. But instead of doing that, they went a shady route instead.
Yeah. Well, it just seems like all the big streaming channels are going for TV shows now and not movies.
Yeah, television is definitely where it's at. It's definitely a bigger concern now is television. For most channels, they get more money out of it, they get more value out of it. So that definitely seems to be what they're into more than anything is TV, and then movies are a close second.
And if I had a dollar for every time someone on a horror group or an exploitation group says, "There's nothing to watch, I'm bored," I'm like, "Do you have a streaming service?" Yeah,
there's
I have all three.
Much stuff. It's impossible. Yeah, it's impossible to keep up. There's so much stuff.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Whenever anyone says, "I've pretty much seen it all," I'm like, "No. I'm a movie psycho, and I still say by the time I die, I'll pretty much only watch 3% at the least of what I probably wanted to watch all my life."
Yeah, I think there's probably no way to actually get it all in. It's just impossible.
Yeah, because there's so many movies. Like, I've seen someone talk about one of yours. Where was this movie? I've been looking for stuff like this. Why hasn't anyone talked about it?
We do the best we can, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you get websites talking about your stuff and all that, and it just seems like, do you read? No. No.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely hard to track down, I mean, to be able to keep up with everything, especially when it comes to indie stuff. You do have to have your head to the ground. You have to really be listening. You have to really be trying to keep up with it all. It can be a job in and of itself.
Yeah, I mean, really. I mean, people are like, I've seen times I made them submit stuff. I was like, wow, this guy was good. Why didn't he make any more? Go to IMDb. He made 20 films? Are you selling your films direct through your website, or is it just going to Vimeo? VOD only.
Oh, no. Pretty much all of my films are available on DVD, and many of them are also available on Blu-ray. For my films, you can find them at henflix.com, henflix.com. That's where I sell all the limited editions, the Blu-rays, the DVDs. And then also many of the horror films I was involved in, you can purchase on DVD and Blu-ray at alternativecinema.com.
And plus, if you order it direct by the director, you can be guaranteed that they're getting all the money. And sometimes, if you just ask them, they might just sign it.
Oh, I sign every title ordered from Henflix.com. I autograph it, and we ship it out within about 2 days of receiving the order at the latest, just to try and make, you know, the fans and the people who are helping us so much know that they are very appreciated. Because when you buy direct, it does help us immensely to keep going.
Yeah. Remember, it's only your money, people, that keeps the independent spirit alive. Because you can make the greatest film in the world, but if no one sees it?
Well, and that's why I've tried to dedicate myself so intensely to providing the best possible customer service I can. I'm a member of a lot of these DVD, Blu-ray trading groups and fan groups. I'm in there because I am one, and I see the horror stories of bad customer service from independent companies, independent artists, and it breaks my heart because, you know, as silly as it sounds, or as it may sound, you know, getting an order for a Blu-ray on a Wednesday, getting $20, you know, that's groceries. That makes a difference in an artist's life. So I just can't imagine treating the people who are paying your bills like they're annoying or like they're bothering you. It's just absurd to me. So know that if you order something from Henflix.com, you will get the fastest possible service, the best quality service, and I'll do everything I can to make you happy because I can't tell you how much it helps. It really, really does.
Yeah, that's it. And plus, I've seen the giveaways there. Some of the people on GoFundMe. And sometimes it seems to me they pay more, spend more on the perks than they put in on the movie.
That does happen sometimes. People don't properly estimate how much the perks are going to cost, so they end up in trouble.
Yeah. Well, that's when you get the starry-eyed guys who go out for their first film, and then instead of just shooting stuff before to see how the nuts and bolts work, they end up with a finished movie and looking like they just seen the most horrible thing in the world happen to them.
Making your first movie is extremely challenging, especially if it's going to be feature length. It's a daunting task, and there's a reason that so many people have only done it a handful of times. And then they kind of step back. It's really hard. It's a really big challenge.
Yeah, the worst case is Charles Laughton with The Night of the Hunter. He was so disappointed by the reviews and how bad it was released that he just gave up and said, I've made one film. I'm not doing anything else. I quit.
I mean, and you know what? I think that that's fair. If your experience is really bad, I don't think you should do something you don't want to do. You know, I can't blame him. I think that, like all things in this world, you know, some people have an aptitude for certain things. Like, I've made a lot of movies in a short period of time, but I don't think that's necessarily the way every filmmaker should work either. I don't think every filmmaker needs, wants, or should make like 2 or 3 movies a year. It's just something that I personally do. So, you know, every filmmaker is different.
Yeah, find your own groove.
And finding groove can take time.
Oh, yeah. Just like at the Knoxville Horror Festival, I go over here, I've seen people who've been making short films for years upon years, and they're great at making short films. But they're scared to take that next step. And I don't blame them.
I mean, it is scary. It's very scary. I mean, it's a huge change. to tell a story in a long form, and it takes a lot of work and effort. So you have to, you know, I say it's smart to be cautious, but at the same time, you got to be a little crazy and a little reckless to just go out and get it done.
Yeah, and that's the people that make the best workers is the crazy ones. The ones you go to and say, hey, I want you to go get up at 2 a.m., 3 a.m. every morning, set your whole day's work, but not get to sleep till about 12 midnight, and go through the process of doing this for a whole month, and then selling it, and hopefully you get your money back, and then doing it again.
It's true, and that's pretty much my life. It is a level of insanity. Every time I get through, I feel like I just survived a war, and then a week and a half later, I'm talking about when I'm going to start again.
Yeah, well, at least you have a small time to forget the bad.
Yeah.
I've heard one director say, Joe Dante, he said, why has it always been like 2 or 3 years between your films? He's like, I had to have the time to forget the bad experience of the last one before I do the new one.
I think that's fair.
And plus, getting funding for it is bad.
I mean, funding movies is extremely hard.
Yeah, especially when you get a producer that wants to force his ideas upon to your movie.
Oh, I mean, like I said, mo money, mo problems, without a doubt.
That even goes on the no-budget films. They get the budget, then the producer starts thinking that he can have a giant say at what goes on in...
I mean, there's a lot of that. Usually, that's in the higher budget range. I mean, when your movie's costing the price of a used car, usually people aren't trying to exert too much control over you, but it can definitely vary.
The time you would have fit in is back in the tax shelter days. That would have been your paradise.
Well, I mean, we still have beneficial tax law, but my movies aren't expensive enough for me to benefit from it.
Well, what I'm talking about is in the 80s, if any money that you spent making a movie or encouraging the arts, if the movie said project loses money, you could declare how much all of it as a loss on your taxes.
Well, you can definitely declare a loss on any business expense as long as the movie doesn't make money, but that it wouldn't behoove me to make a bunch of movies that don't make money. So I wouldn't enjoy that era, because as of this moment, I have
what
not.
What I mean is there have been a lot of people who would just
money.
Say, Heinrich, are you making a movie? Yes. Okay, I want a $10,000. I want like a $1 million tax break. Here's the money. Make your movie. But we might not make money.
Well,
oh, good, good, good. Here's the money. Just make it. I can write it off.
I think that had a lot more to do with the economy in that era as well.
Yeah. But they closed that loophole pretty dang quick.
I mean, yeah, I suppose they did. I mean, you can still, if you have a lot of money and want to get around paying taxes, investing it is the way to go if you get a loss. But I'm also not a tax expert. But, yeah.
Yeah, in the no-budget area, it's like, lose money. You got to have it to lose it.
That's true. That's very true.
Do you do a lot of conventions in your area to promote and sell your films?
I try to. I do a lot of... I do Cinema Wasteland in Cleveland, Ohio, and then I do I often do Chiller Theater out in New Jersey, and I'll occasionally do other events here and there, depending. But those are kind of the ones I spend the most time at.
Wasteland's cool, but bless you, my son, for trying to make non-autographed money at Chiller.
I'm sorry, say again?
Bless you, my son, for trying to make non-autographed money at Chiller.
It's not easy, I'll tell you that much.
I think last year they had like 80 guests doing autograph sessions.
It's a lot. They definitely have a lot. So, well, I just saw it's 3:05. I really do have to get going, my friend, but I really appreciate you having me on.
Okay, don't worry. It's over. We did. It's over. Thank you for being on. And tell people where to buy your stuff again.
Absolutely. If you guys are curious about the work I've done, just go over to henflix.com. That's henflix.com. And nearly every film that I've directed is available on that site on DVD and Blu-ray. And if you buy it from there, it comes autographed at no additional charge. And you're really helping keep the ship sailing of independent film.
Yeah, and thank you for being on, and goodbye, everybody.
Thank you very much.
To all praise, hush, whore, bulldog, and for downright real people, I want you to listen. Be what you are, and be the very best of what you are. Whatever your thing is, make your own self a star. When y'all see me riding around here with gold handles on each one of my doors, they have the nerve to say that motherfucker is pimping whore. You call me a liar, a thief, son of, you even call me a freak. Then you say that motherfucker done got on top. He must have done it by eating cock. But if all of that was done behind closed doors was brought to light, there'd be a whole lot of cocksuckers and dick lickers and freakish motherfuckers sitting right out here tonight. So what have you got to take, and what have you got to give? As long as I live the life that I love, because I love the life that I live. But furthermore, if you'd stir your finger round up in your own pot, you would be too damn busy trying to find out what kind of dick that I've got. So I'm going to live for today, because I'm not promised tomorrow. I want plenty of good loving and less pain and sorrow. So I'm going to keep on living and being what I am. And I'm going to be the very best of what I am. And for those who don't like it, confidentially, I don't give a damn. Because I live the life that I love, and I love the life that I live.